This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Sarah Bergman, a Seattle artist and designer. Sarah Bergman is here today to tell us about the Pollinator Pathway, a plan to provide urban support to the foundation of the food web. Welcome, Sarah.
Thanks for having me, Diane.
Would you like to begin by giving an overview of the project?
Sure. The Pollinator Pathway is a plan to create a mile-long and 12-foot-wide series of pollinator-friendly gardens in planting strips. So that's that sort of narrow strip of grass between sidewalks and streets. The project site is located on Seattle's Columbia Street, and it runs between 12th and 29th Avenue. It spans about a third of the city's width, and the idea of the project is to create a corridor of ecosystem connectivity between two existing green spaces to expand the ecological benefits that those green spaces already provide. So the two spaces that I chose for the endpoints of the project are Seattle University, which is at 12th Avenue, and they're known for their sustainable landscaping practices. They also house some mason bee nesting sites, and they have a pollinator-focused garden on their campus. So Nora's Woods is at the other end, and that's at 29th Avenue, and it's a small native plant woods that houses several bird species, including a hawk. So the project basically just tries to connect these two spaces up ecologically by this thin corridor of flowering gardens.
Would you like to comment on the importance of pollinators and also their current status?
So 90% of the world's plants depend on pollinators, and pollinators worldwide are in decline, mostly due to habitat loss and pesticides. These pollinators exist in pockets through the U.S., and the project looks at what we in cities can do at a minimum level to help support the native ecology that they're a part of. Cities can play an important role in supporting pollinators and the plants that they depend on, and of course then the birds that depend on them. The nice thing is that it's really easy to do, really easy to support these native pollinators, in the sense that if we just provide the correct elements that they need, they'll come. Native plants and native pollinators have co-evolved together, and so many of the ornamental plants that we enjoy in our gardens don't always provide the ecological value that native creatures need. So simply adding native plants to our existing gardens alongside all the other plants that we enjoy would make a world of difference for these pollinators.
What led to your personal interest in designing a pollinator pathway?
I got interested in this because of colony collapse and the honeybee. So the more I read about what was happening to them, the more interested I got in trying to create a project that would allow me to learn more about native pollinators and to create a positive project that supported them. When most people think of pollinators, they think of the honeybee. The honeybee is a non-native species, and it was first brought to the United States by European settlers. Many went feral, and they sort of naturalized into the landscape, taking about 200 years to head west. They were referred to as the white man's fly, actually, by Native Americans. So historically, we've used honeybees for wax and honey, but in addition to that, we now use them for a whole other purpose, which is pollination services. So about one in every three bites of our food is pollinated. Without pollinators, we would have to rely on wind-pollinated foods, such as corn and soy, and also wheat. So our large-scale agricultural system relies heavily on the honeybee, which is their main pollinator. To give you a sense of scale, California produces about 80% of the world's almond supply. And so once a year, U.S. beekeepers truck their bees to California to pollinate the almonds. And that single bloom event uses about 1.3 million hives. It's a little more than half of all the commercial hives in the U.S. So large-scale agriculture is really a system of single-species landscapes. When a monocrop blooms, from a pollinator perspective, it means it's a total bonanza of food for a really short period of time. So when that bloom period ends, then it's a sort of food wasteland for a pollinator. One way we've worked our way around that, agriculturally speaking, is to use the honeybee, because we can truck the honeybees in and they don't need to rely on the local ecology. This has really worked for a while, but honeybees are not doing very well, most especially with colony collapse disorder, which is decimating their populations. So overall, we're relying very heavily on a single species to provide us with a big portion of our food supply, and that's simply not a very sustainable strategy overall. So native pollinators can actually do this same job, but they're on the decline as well. They need a food supply that also reflects their life cycle. That pretty much means native plants, which are adapted to coexist with them. So to backtrack, pollinators are kind of the glue that holds the whole ecosystem together. Native pollinators, they pollinate about 90% of the flowering plants of the world. Plants can't move, obviously, so they rely on a vector to do the job. These vectors can be wind or water, but for the most part, they're done by pollinators. And those pollinators can be bees or butterflies and moths and bats and ants and beetles and flies, as well as some mammals. Mostly it's bees, though, that are doing this. And native bees, they're not like honeybees at all, meaning they don't have the social colony that we associate with honeybees. Native bees tend to be ground and twig nesting, and they live solitary lives, with the exception of bumblebees, which tend to nest in colonies of about 100 or so, and they produce a very tiny amount of honey. There's about 40,000 species of bees worldwide, and 800 to 1,000 in the Northwest alone. Some pollinators can be highly specialized, while others are generalists. The honeybee, you can probably guess, is a generalist forager. But some pollinators have highly evolved relationships with certain plants, such as the Darwin orchid, which has a 12-inch long nectar spur. Someone famously sent a specimen to Darwin, who predicted that someone would find a pollinator that matched it. And surely enough, 40 years after his death, they found a species of moth that has a 12-inch long proboscis. Another example is the fig wasp, which has a tiny little wasp that actually crawls inside of figs to pollinate its flowers. The flowers on a fig are located on the inside of the fig, and the female crawls inside, lays her eggs, and pollinates the flowers as she goes, and then she dies inside the fig. Incidentally, the fig does absorb her body, so you're not actually eating fig wasps. So those wasps are the only pollinators that pollinate figs. And locally, there's some specialized relationships, like the silvery blue butterfly, which relies on the Viola adunca, which is a dogtooth violet, for its host plant, which is where it lays its eggs. My interest is in finding out what these relationships are and to create situations where they're encouraged. And this is actually a little harder than it sounds because there's not that much information that's readily available, simply because it's pretty hard to physically track these pollinators. And also because we're only recently beginning to recognize the importance of their roles in the ecosystem.
Which species are the most important pollinators here in the Puget Sound area?
I wouldn't really say that one is more important than the other. I think the overall idea is to encourage a wide diversity of species, to increase the possibility of overlap in species. I do have a couple of personal favorites, of course, and one of them is the mason bee. It's a cute and fuzzy bee that's pretty docile. It doesn't really tend to sting. In fact, the males have no stinger, and they pollinate native plants as well as many orchard crops. So incidentally, they can really support a lot of the urban farming that's happening in Seattle. In addition, the western bumblebee is another favorite, and that happens to be on the decline throughout Washington.
What role do pollinators play in addition to pollination?
In addition to pollinating plants, the pollinators also support other creatures, such as birds and bats, which eat the pollinators. So a bat can eat, you know, hundreds of insects in one night. So overall, supporting pollinators means creating more abundance in the ecosystem.
Would you give us a brief history of how the Pollinator Pathway Project came about?
Sure. I began the project in 2008 and basically researched what plants pollinators are interested in and selected a location, and then started to work with the Department of Transportation to make sure that we fit their guidelines. Then we worked with the homeowners to learn what plants they prefer from the existing plant list that we had. And from there, we work with volunteers to replace grass, which provides almost no ecological value, with plants that provide pollinators with food. We currently have about 25 homeowners signed up on our wait list for new gardens, and we have lots of enthusiastic volunteers that make it all happen. We'll be planting the next 9 gardens this spring and 7 more this fall. Over time, I hope to set up a system of volunteers to help the homeowners with the future maintenance of the project, and I'm in talks with a local organization about developing this project as one of their programs.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is artist and designer Sarah Bergman. Our topic is the Seattle Pollinator Pathway Project, a plan to provide urban support to the foundation of the food web. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. Would you like to elaborate on the purpose of the Pollinator Pathway Project in terms of your goals?
Sure. We plan to just basically provide food and habitat to pollinators. We are trying to increase the ecological activity in that area and also to provide an educational platform for learning about the kinds of plants that native pollinators prefer, get people interested in plants and pollinators, and to share information with people interested in, you know, helping out. And also to monitor the area and see if we are actually doing any benefit.
Would you like to say more about the educational aspect of your project?
Sure. The project serves sort of as an educational platform where we're not only teaching people about organic gardening, but about native plants and natural and human systems. The project is also highly collaborative, so we've worked with a number of different people from a variety of different professions to build the project, including a really wonderful relationship with Studio Matthews, which is a design firm here in Seattle. And they worked with the UW Design School to create all of the visual elements of the project. We also worked with garden designer Robin Ginac on creating the garden design for the pollinators. So in addition to that, there's a new collaboration that I'm really excited about, and that's that we're going to be working with Seattle University's ecology program to monitor the project for pollinator visits. And we'll be reporting those sightings to the Butterflies and Moths of North America site. In addition to the sightings that we'll be reporting, we're going to be monitoring the soil ecosystem and comparing the complexity and the activity of sites that we've not done compared to the gardens that we've created.
Are there other projects that help inspire you to design the pollinator pathway?
Definitely. There's a couple, there's a whole bunch actually, but two that really stand out are Yellowstone to Yukon and the High Line in New York. So Yellowstone to Yukon is a coalition that's working to maintain and restore the region between Yellowstone and the Yukon. It's a migratory corridor for large mammals, so it's really a big scale version of what I'm interested in doing in the city. And the idea is to, again, form some connectivity between these larger designated locations. I don't know all the day-to-day details of their project, but it was very inspiring to me when I began thinking about this, because it's a very sort of pragmatic approach that they seem to be taking, where they, you know, really try to figure out what to do in each situation, whether it's, you know, buy up a parcel of land or create wildlife fencing. So that was very inspiring. And the other one is the High Line, and that's a project in New York City, and it's, I believe, a 1.5-mile-long park that's being developed. It could be just a mile. It is an elevated rail line that's being converted into a park, and they've been working on it for close to 20 years, and just recently were able to develop the first section.
How good is the current habitat for pollinators in Seattle?
So from a pollinator perspective, cities are somewhat unpredictable. We have a lot of green space in Seattle, but it's not all quality foraging material. Grass especially doesn't provide real food for pollinators. And another factor of a city landscape is that it, you know, sort of changes with homeowner interests. So where any city can really increase their pollinator activity is through their park systems and, you know, through things like traffic medians and traffic circles, that kind of thing.
Would you elaborate on the role of cities in protecting pollinators as opposed to the country? Why focus on protecting and encouraging pollinators in a city?
So cities are not a primary solution, but they can play a part in supporting the food chain. While we wouldn't want to encourage, say, large mammals coming into cities, a city can play a part in the local ecology simply by providing a bridge of plant life that supports existing ecology in outlying areas. I see the city as part of a bigger system of landscape patterns. So from an ecological perspective, you could look at it like a series of rings, with the outer ring way beyond the city, the wilderness, or the more complex landscape. And then you step in a bit and you're looking at farmland and potentially urban sprawl. So that's where the landscape changes, and we're looking at a, you know, slightly more simplified ecosystem of crop species, some native plants, and some invasive plants, and then introduced garden ornamentals. If you go a ring further into the city core, you have the most simplified ecosystem of all three, where the landscape is really primarily made up of introduced ornamentals, lawn grass, and invasive species, the further you go into the urban core. So cities should not be a primary pollinator protection area, but they can be part of a bigger system where cities are providing sort of a bare minimum of ecologically considered plant life. People can really help here by planting native flowering plants.
Would you say more about why you chose the location you did, the mile strip along Columbia Street?
Sure. I guess it was mostly for personal reasons. I used to go hang out in Nora's Woods. I thought it was really beautiful little woods, and I would learn about the native plants that were there. They have great little signs there, so I learned a lot. And so that was sort of the starting point when I thought about the project. And so then I looked around for something to connect to with this corridor. And Seattle University was a really natural choice. They are well known for their sustainable landscaping, and they've been doing it since the 70s. They use integrated pest management, and yeah, they just do really wonderful work.
What type of plants do pollinators prefer? Would you say more about that? What type of garden is overall pollinator friendly?
That tends to vary. So there's generalist pollinators and specialist pollinators. And, you know, you can say sort of a general set of things about certain pollinators, such as, you know, butterflies tend to prefer flat flowers and they have a preference for yellow and white flowers. Bats tend to prefer night blooming flowers, and bees tend to prefer blue flowers. Overall, pollinators like plantings that are in groups, and then butterflies, you know, need areas where they can kind of rest next to plantings. In addition, they also need plants that they can use as their host plants where they can lay their eggs, and then they also need nectar plants. So they sort of have two specific needs.
How did you specifically go about designing the gardens that you've planted so far that are along Columbia Street? What factors did you consider in putting them together?
So the gardens will be built from 70 to 90% native plants, and we're sort of focusing on basic things that we know that pollinators will like. So we follow a general set of needs for pollinators, such as yellow flowers and possibly white flowers for butterflies, and blue and purple flowers for bees, and then red tubular flowers for hummingbirds. Once we do that, we'll be looking at more specialized relationships for pollinators that have specific needs.
How far along is the Pollinator Pathway project currently? You said a bit about that earlier, but where do things stand, and what are your plans over the next few months?
In the next few months, we are planning for our next big garden day. So May 14 and 15 is when we'll be planting the gardens, and then we'll be doing another one in the fall. And so far, we have two gardens in place, and one is on 27th and Columbia, and the other one is just off of 16th. And then we have nine new gardens that are freshly mulched that we just did this fall. So we had about 100 people come out and help us create those. And we're doing sheet mulching, so we're putting down cardboard, which we got from Cleanscapes, and we're putting mulch on top of that to kill the grass rather than haul it away. So we're just doing the planning right now. We're, you know, ordering the plants and making sure that all the homeowners like the garden designs that we've been developing. And yeah, that's it. So we're mostly just preparing for this next garden day work party.
Do you see the project being completed by the end of this year? Or?
No, I think what will happen is in the fall, we'll be sheet mulching a whole new round of gardens. And then we'll probably, you know, that needs to sit for 6 months so that the grass dies. So we'll be planting the next round and the final round in the spring of 2012.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Sarah Bergman. Our topic is the Seattle Pollinator Pathway, a plan to provide urban support to the foundation of the food web. What have you observed so far in the first two gardens that you've planted?
Well, we've learned a lot, and it's been really interesting. So we've learned a lot about what kinds of plants do well in these kinds of environments. They're not very hospitable. And when we selected these plants, we worked with a bunch of different criteria. We obviously picked plants for, you know, what pollinators were attracted to them, but we also worked with the Department of Transportation to make sure that we fit their height requirements. And then we also needed to find drought-tolerant plants because we don't want the homeowners to have to spend a lot of extra money taking care of them, which in addition to that, we also looked for low-maintenance plants. So it's a lot to fit into one little strip. So we have really been learning a lot about which plants work and don't work, and we've been eliminating the plants that do not work. We've also been observing what pollinators come, and it's been really gratifying to see the amounts of pollinators that are showing up. And also, one other factor was that there were no worms in the soil when we started, and now they're just filled with worms. It's really exciting to see.
And what do the pollinators look like? If you come up upon the garden, what do you see in terms of the pollinators?
Mostly we're seeing bumblebees and some mason bees. That seems to be the primary, too.
What have been some of the challenges in developing the gardens?
Gosh, I guess mostly we've been, you know, it's just been trying to figure out what these pollinators want, like what their needs are. And, you know, also these city ecosystems are very simplified. And, you know, are we planning for pollinators that could theoretically exist there or pollinators that actually exist there? And then are those invasive species or are they sort of species that, you know, quote unquote, should be there? So it's a kind of interesting balancing act.
Where does support for the project come from?
We've had really wonderful support from the city. So we got two different grants from the Department of Neighborhoods, and we've also received funding from Seattle University and from private donors.
What kind of response are you getting so far to the Pollinator Pathway project?
It's been overwhelmingly positive. The homeowners have been really easy to work with, and yeah, overall we just get, you know, great emails and comments from people.
Do you find there are people that live in other parts of the city that would like to start a pollinator pathway in their neighborhood?
Yeah, definitely. A group just down the street actually created a garden in their planting strip, and we helped them with providing signs, little miniature street signs that we've developed for the project that identify the plants.
When you finish the strip on Columbia Street, do you have plans yourself to move into other parts of the city to develop projects?
Yeah, definitely. We are developing this project in the hopes of being able to replicate it in other cities.
And have any of those projects started at this point?
No, not at this point, but we are in talks with a couple of different organizations about that.
How can listeners become involved in the Pollinator Pathway project?
They could certainly come join us for our work parties. We'd be delighted to see you, and you don't need any experience whatsoever. So our next work parties are on May 14 and 15, and you can certainly check our website to find out more details, but we'll be spread out along Columbia Street between 12th and 29th, so you pretty much just show up between 11 and 4, and we'll be there. In addition, we are having a picnic down at the Corson Building, which is a restaurant in Georgetown, and that will benefit the pollinator pathway, so that should be great fun. And that's coming up in June, on June 26th, and that'll be from noon to 5. In addition, you can create your own pollinator-friendly garden in your yard or wherever you've got available land. We've got planting templates that help you create gardens with pollinators in mind, and you can download those for free on our website at pollinatorpathway.com.
Would you say, repeat again, the types of plants that people should consider if they're planting their own pollinator-friendly garden? What are some suggestions and other suggestions for how to make a pollinator-friendly garden?
Certainly. So, you know, overall, if you choose native plants, you're doing a world of good. And for Seattle, you could certainly look at our website. We've got, you know, something like 50 plants that are known pollinator-friendly plants that you could choose from.
Is there anything else they can do?
In the Northwest, you could certainly keep native pollinators if you're interested in that. The mason bee is very easy to keep, and you can buy nesting blocks online or you can make them yourself. Or bumblebees, those are fairly easy nests to make if you wanted to go a step further.
What is your long-term goal for the Pollinator Pathway Project?
Well, overall, my goal is to finish it. It's a big project, and we're, you know, only about a quarter of the way through right now. So that's our primary goal, to really create a full line of these gardens between these two big green spaces. And I also would really like to integrate it into a lot more classrooms. We've worked with a couple of different classrooms, and we would really like to do more of that. So we have students come out and we talk about native pollinators and sort of urban ecosystems, and then they come and work on the gardens, and that's great fun. In addition, I would like to fold this project into a larger organization. So that's another goal of mine.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Just that you can help native pollinators by planting native plants, and that you can do so by integrating them into your existing gardens. There's no real need to, you know, change out your garden entirely. You can just simply tuck in native plants, and you're doing a, you know, huge world of good for these pollinators.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Sarah.
Thank you.
You have just been listening to Sarah Bergman speak about the Pollinator Pathway Project. For more information, check on the web at www.pollinatorpathway.com. Again, that's pollinatorpathway.com. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and kexp.org.